cracked, water dripped from a damaged pipe somewhere in the walls. The floor was wet, and the smell back here was awful. I edged forward carefully, debating switching to night vision, but the light was enough so that I could pick my way. My foot touched something, and I looked down to see the bloated corpse of a dead rat lying there, its eyes and mouth open, tongue lolling. I stepped over it and moved forward until I reached the first door. It was closed and blocked by a row of dented trash cans filled with all kinds of junk. Old coats, bent umbrellas, broken toys, newspapers, soiled diapers. Even with the cold, there were flies buzzing everywhere, and the stench intensified. I held my breath while I placed the chameleon bug and keycard scanner and was grateful when I could move away. There was more trash in the hallway. Odd stuff. A deflated football lying on a brand new left sneaker. An open briefcase whose papers had spilled out and become soaked with rust-colored water. A smashed cell phone. Two frisbees and a push-up bra. Half a dozen iPods. Dozens of letters, most of them junk mail and bills, still sealed and stamped. The broken body of a headless Barbie doll. An overturned shopping cart filled with aluminum cans. The sight of the junk scattered in the dark and rusty water gave me the creeps. Bad thoughts were forming in my head, and the sane half of my brain was telling me to do an about-face and get the hell out of here. I moved along the hall to bug the last three doors before the hallway ended at another bend. With my pistol in both hands, I hugged the near wall and then quick looked around the corner, dodging my head in and back and then analyzing the flash image. What I saw sent an icy chill rippling down my spine. Oh, man, I thought. Don't let me be right about this. I rounded the corner, still checking for cameras and threats, pistol barrel following my line of vision so that it pointed everywhere I looked. In front of me was a big set of double doors. It wasn't the door, or even the stench, that made me feel like there wasn't enough air to breathe. The floor was heaped with lots more clothes, more personal items, more human detritus. Some of it looked new, undamaged. It looked like stuff that had been taken away from ordinary people. A lot of ordinary people. The door was sealed with a heavy padlock that was cinched tight through heavy metal rings that had been welded to the steel doorframe. And the door, the surrounding walls, and the floor were all smeared with some viscous substance that had dried to a chocolatey brown color. I bent close and saw that hidden by the smeared goo were wires that trailed up the wall and disappeared into small holes that had been drilled through the concrete. I turned and followed the wires down the wall and along the hall for 5 feet, to where they vanished behind a fire extinguisher that was mounted at chest height. Booby trap. Pretty well hidden, too. The question was whether the charge was inside the extinguisher or inside that locked room. Or both. Screw this. I backed carefully away, then stopped and looked at where the water lapped against the bottom of the door. The rust color was richer and redder by the door, as if something inside were feeding pigment to the mix. Understanding hit me like a punch, and I rose quickly and backed away from the door, feeling my heart hammering as an atavistic dread sprang up in my chest. I stared at the stained water and the smears on the walls as the full horror of it sank in. The dark muck smeared on the doors was not mud, and the water wasn't stained with rust. All of it, every square inch of it, was blood. Chapter 62, Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 3:23 a.m. I took a step forward and leaned as close to the door as I could without touching it. Beyond was silence, and yet it was a strange silence, like someone holding their breath on the other end of a phone line. You're sure they're there, but you can't hear anything. I didn't like this one damn bit and moved back to the bend in the hall. No sign of Ollie and no sounds from his direction. That silence didn't feel good either, but it wasn't the same as what I'd sensed, or imagined, from beyond that grisly door. I crouched down behind the trash cans and tapped my earpiece to open the secure channel to the DMS. "Deacon, do you read?" "This is Cowboy," I said, using the code names we agreed upon before we saddled up. Rudy had suggested mine. Knowing the military sense of humor, it could have been a lot worse. I knew a guy back in the Rangers who got hung with the code name Cindy Lou Who.
"Reading, Cowboy, this is Deacon."
The headsets were so good it was like Church had snuck up behind me again and was whispering in my ear. I quickly reported what I'd found, including the locked door and the blood.
"Leave it for now. All video went black as soon as you entered the building. We're receiving zero wireless intel. Audio signal is fluctuating but still operational. Assume jamming devices. What's your team status?"
"Scarface is taking a walk down the hall. Joker is on surveillance. Rest of team is at door knock." I decided to give my team the nicknames I'd mentally hung on them when I met them. Joker, Scarface, Sergeant Rock, and Green Giant.
"Note this. The ambient temperature whole building is just above freezing. Climate controlled. Confirm understood."
"Understood, confirmed."
There was a brief pause, and I could guess we were both looking at that from the same angle. Church said,
"It's your call, Cowboy. Come home, go for a walk, or throw a party."
"Roger that." I paused and considered my options. "We'll continue to take a walk. All options open, however. Confirm Amazing is on station." Amazing, shorthand for Amazing Grace.
"That is affirmative. Cowboy out."
I tapped the earpiece again to connect to the team channel.
"Scarface, what's your 20?
There was no answer. Not even a squelch click.
"Scarface, this is Cowboy. Do you copy?"
Nothing.
Shit.
I looked down the corridor, but it was as empty as before. It told me nothing.
"Green Giant and Sergeant Rock on my 6, quick and quiet."
"Roger that, Cowboy."
I started moving as fast as caution would allow, retracing my steps down the hallway, happy to get away from that terrible door. At the T-junction, I paused and looked to see Bunny's hulking form moving quickly toward me with Top Sims 2 steps behind him.
"Scarface went down there and doesn't answer," I said,
and quickly filled them in on the locked and barred room and the detonation wires in the walls. Bunny frowned. "Trap?" Top Sims turned to him.
"If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck."
"This is Fubar, boss?"
Bunny asked, looking up and down the hall.
"The little drama at the front door could have been as much a fake-out on their part as ours."
"Probably was," I said, "but until we know for sure, we have to try and complete the mission as assigned. Gather intel and get out with a whole skin."
"I dig the whole skin part a lot," said Bunny.
"Hurrah,"
Top agreed. Then he gave me a hard look.
"Arlie going missing with no shots fired is a little strange, don't you think?"
"A bit."
"We still don't know who the mole is, Captain," he pointed out.
"Roger that, First Sergeant, but I'm not going to hang a label on any of my men until I know for sure."
Top kept his stare steady for maybe 10 whole seconds before he grudgingly said,
"Yes, sir."
"Not to piss in the punch bowl here," interrupted Bunny, "but isn't this all a bit beside the point right now? Begging your pardons, I mean y'all being senior to a lowly staff sergeant."
"Shove that where the sun don't shine, farm boy,"
Top said, but he was grinning. Bunny rubbed his eyes.
"Man, this is getting to be a long-ass day."
I nodded in the direction of the corridor where Ollie had gone missing.
"Primary mission rules still apply. Watch and wait. No shooting except on my say-so. And even then, watch your fire and check your targets."
We went right at the T-bend and then left to follow the hall. We were three-quarters of the way down the hall when one of the side doors abruptly opened and a man in a white lab coat stepped out, head bent as he frowned over notes on a clipboard, 4 feet from Top. There was nowhere to hide, no time to run. The man looked up from his clipboard and his eyes snapped wide. His mouth opened, and I could actually see his chest expand as he drew in a sharp breath in order to scream. But Top rose up lightning fast and kicked him hard in the solar plexus with the tip of his steel-reinforced left shoe. It was a savage kick, and the man's whole body folded around Top's foot like a deflating balloon, and then he dropped to the floor with a strangled squeak. We swarmed him and had plastic cuffs on his wrists and ankles before he could manage to drag in a full breath of air. His dark skin had gone purple. Top went to the door through which the man had passed and looked in, then turned to me and gave a negative shake of the head. Bunny grabbed a handful of the man's shirt front and screwed the barrel of his pistol into the furrow between the man's eyes.
"Be quiet and stay alive," he whispered.
The guy was still bug-eyed from the kick, and his eyes bulged even more when he realized that there were three big and well-armed men clustered around him. We had the power of life and death over him, and he knew it. Total and unexpected helplessness can be an event that purifies the soul. It sharpens one's mental focus. I leaned close and said in Farsi, "Do you speak English?" He shook his head, as much as Bunny's pistol barrel would allow, and then rattled off something in what I think was Myanmar, what they used to call Burmese, not one of my languages.
"Do you speak English?"
I said in my own language.
"Yes, yes, English. I speak very good."
"Lucky for you. I'm going to ask you a few questions, and if you answer me truthfully and completely, my friend here will not shoot you. You understand?"
"Yes. Yes, I understand."
"What's your name?"
"Nujoma."
"Indian? Burmese?"
"Yes, yes, I come from Rangoon in Burma."
"How many people are in this building?"
"I'm only—"
His voice cracked and he tried it again.
"I am only a technician."
"That's not what I asked. How many?"
I cannot, they will kill me."
I grabbed him by the throat. "What do you think I'll do if you don't answer me?"
"They have my wife, my children, my sister. I cannot—"
"Who has them? Where? Are they here in this building?"
"No. They took them from my home. They have them."
"Who took them?" I demanded again. He shook his head. Bunny tapped him on the forehead with the barrel.
"Answer the man's questions or the day's going to end in a way you won't like."
But Bunny's threat was of no use. The man's eyes filled with tears and he clamped his mouth shut, giving tiny shakes of his head. I looked into his eyes and felt like I could see all the way down into the man's soul. He wasn't a terrorist. This guy was just another victim. I shifted back a few inches to try and decrease the sense of threat, and when I spoke, I softened my voice.
"If you talk to us, I promise that we'll see what we can do to help your family."
But he shook his head, resolute in his terror.
"Tick-tock," Top muttered.
"Okay," I said. "Juice me." Top fished a hypodermic from his chest pocket, removed the plastic cap, and passed it to me. The technician's eyes flared wider, and tears spilled down his face. As I positioned the needle over his throat, he began murmuring something in his native language. I bent forward, hoping to catch a word or phrase, but then realized from the rhythm of his words that he was mumbling prayers. I plunged the needle. The tranquilizer knocked him cold in 3 seconds, and he slumped to the floor.
"Bunny, take him back to the door. Tell Skip to alert Church that we have his prisoner. If he's been infected with the same control disease as the others, then we'll need to question him before he kicks. Drop him and get back here ASAP."
"You got it, boss. But man, I'd hate to be in this guy's shoes. I wouldn't want Church questioning me."
He hoisted Nujoma over his shoulders in a fireman's carry and ran down the hall, his pace showing no indication that he was carrying at least 150 extra pounds. Now that we were alone, I touched his arm.
"Top, you seem to have a bug about Ollie."
"Why him?" He kept looking down the hall.
"Bunny was with us in room 12. Says a lot. Ollie came in with everyone else. I don't like it that he was slow to respond."
"So was Skip."
"Skip's a kid. Whoever this mole is, he's got field experience. He's slick enough to have pulled a fast one on Church and the whole DMS. Besides, Ollie's done a lot of work for the company."
"The CIA? How do you know that?"
"He told us when we were trying to sort out who should be team leader. He said that he'd done extensive covert ops work. He's a spook, and I don't trust spooks."
"It could be anyone," I said. "The DMS is ass deep in spooks and spies."
"Yeah," Top agreed slowly. "It sure could be anyone. For all you know, it could be me. If I'd opened that door, then going back to room 12 with you and Bunny would have been perfect cover. Go in and pop a few caps, who'd suspect me?"
"Yet you cleared Bunny because he was there. Double standard, Top?"
"Maybe I'm trying to confuse you, Captain."
"You're not. So where's that leave us?" A smile blossomed on his dark face.
It changed him, knocking years off, but even so it never reached his eyes.
I guess it leaves us both up shit creek, Cap'n. Personally, I don't plan to trust nobody.
Trust is a hard thing to come by in this world.
It surely is.
We let it drop and turned our attention to the room the Burmese lab tech had come out of. I snapped on the lights and we looked around at banks of computers, big ones that whirred constantly. The temperature of the room was even lower than the rest of the building. A wall-mounted thermometer read 35 degrees. I examined the nearest computer, which was about the size of a Coca-Cola machine. The make and model were on brass plates screwed to the casing. I tapped the mic.
Cowboy to Deacon, over.
Deacon?
Does the name IBM Blue Gene L mean anything to you?
It does. Why?
I'm standing in a room full of them. Advise.
Cowboy, be advised you are holding winning lottery ticket.
Nice to know. Infill starting to get noisy, one guest catching Z's, Green Giant taking him to back door. Joker is minding that location. Advise.
There was a slight pause, and I could imagine Church nibbling the edge of a vanilla wafer as he considered his answer.
Team status?
Scarface is MIA, conducting search. My call is this, radio silence 10 minutes plus 1 second, then kick the doors, cowboy out.
The second I switched back to the team channel, Bunny's voice filled my ear.
Cowboy, cowboy, this is Green Giant, be advised Joker is MIA.
I looked at Top, who was frowning.
Repeat and verify, Green Giant.
Verified, Joker is MIA. No time for code, boss. Our long guns are gone and the back door is sealed. Some kind of security shutter rolled down over it. We're in a box.
Drop your cargo and get back here on the double, I snapped. Top and I rushed out into the hall, guns ready.
That's two down, Top said.
We turned to see Bunny running up the hall like an offensive tackle after a slow quarterback. He skidded to a stop.
I left the prisoner at the door and called it in. No sign of Skip.
I hit the button for the DMS channel. Cowboy to Deacon, cowboy to Deacon, request immediate hard infill. Kick the doors, repeat, kick the doors. But all I heard over my headset was the hiss of static. The signal was gone. A sudden noise made us all jump and we formed a fast circle, guns pointing out. Somewhere deep inside the building there was a sound like the dying sigh of a giant as big turbine engines shut down, slowing their whine as they decelerated.
What the hell was that?
Top growled.
I think the refrigeration units just shut off, Bunny whispered.
Then there was a loud blast as wall-mounted vents snapped from open and hot air shot into the corridor.
Uh-oh, Top said softly.
The air coming out of the vents was intensely hot, and within seconds the temperature in the hall had gone up 10 degrees, then 15. It continued to climb.
Something tells me this is not good news, Bunny said, looking over his shoulder at me.
I tried calling Church again, but still got only silence. It was the same on all channels. Signals being jammed.
Yeah, Bunny confirmed, not good news.
Told you this was a goddamn trap, Top said.
And at that moment the locks on all of the doors along the hallway clicked open. That's when we heard the first moans as dozens of pale-faced people staggered out into the hall in front of us and behind. This wasn't a trap. It was a slaughterhouse.
Chapter 63. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 3:31 a.m. We were trapped, front and back. The closest of the people was 20 feet down the hall. It was a middle-aged woman with lank blonde hair and a stained house dress. Her eyes were wide, and she staggered and nearly fell as the crowd of them jostled her. I brought my pistol up and put the laser sight on her forehead. Bunny and Top were aiming at opposite ends of the hall, but none of us fired yet. My finger was still outside the trigger guard, and I could feel cold slush churning in my stomach. These were civilians. Behind the woman was a young boy of no more than 10, and next to him a pretty teenage girl in a short denim skirt. There were people in business suits and bathing suits, and I caught the flash of a uniform and saw a mailman.
"Orders, sir,"
hissed Top. My finger stayed outside of the trigger guard. "We have to make sure."
"Boss, this is getting tight," Bunny whispered.
I wondered if this was what Baker and Charlie teams had felt at St. Michael's. Was it the absolute inhumanity of the necessary response that kept them from shooting? The meatpacking plant had been different.
That had been a straight good guys, bad guys shootout, but these people were not enemy combatants, at least not yet. The crowd choked the hallway in both directions, but they milled there, not moving forward, staring at us as we stared back. It was completely surreal. "Hold your positions," I said, staring at the crowd. The moment felt like it was stretching, but in reality I knew that only a second or two had ticked off the clock.
"Maybe they ain't walkers," Bunny said.
"Safe, on boy," Top said. "Why don't you go check 'em for a pulse?"
"Screw that."
The middle-aged woman took an uncertain step toward us. I slipped my finger inside the trigger guard. She opened her mouth, and for a moment I thought I saw her smile, as if she was showing relief that someone had come to rescue her, but that smile stretched and stretched and stretched until it became a rapacious leer. With a scream like some jungle animal, she ran straight at me. Once, she had probably been somebody's mother, somebody's wife, maybe a grandmother with grandkids in diapers that she spoiled. I didn't know who she was or how she came to be here in this terrible place. All I knew is that she was here, and whatever loving personality she might have once had, and whatever memories and secrets she once knew, were gone now, torn away by a prion-driven parasite in her blood that left behind only a shell, a predatory thing in human disguise. This, surely, was what Baker and Charlie teams had felt, the dreadful certainty that no action could be right in a situation so thoroughly wrong. They must have felt the horror that I now felt as this woman lunged at me, running on pale legs marked with varicose veins, closing the distance in bedroom slippers that had a lilac print, her stomach bouncing, her breasts swaying, her mouth open in a feral grin of unnatural appetite. It was enough to take the heart and soul out of anyone. It had taken the soul out of all those men and women in those other two DMS teams. But I shot her through the face without hesitation.
"Dear God,
what does that say about who and what I am?" Behind me, Bunny and Top opened up. We all still had the sound suppressors on our guns, so the fight became a ballet of muted carnage. The walkers in the back of the crowd moaned, and that sounded low and distant. The ones in the front screeched like cats, and our handguns made high, soft sounds like someone saying, "Psst," to get everyone's attention. Even as we fired, the moment continued to be unreal. There were at least 20 of them on my side of the corridor, and probably that many charging at my men. The narrow width of the hallway gave us no way out, but it also pushed them together into a line two abreast. They couldn't surround us, couldn't overwhelm us with their numbers. The magazine in my Beretta 9mm carried 15 rounds, and I used them to kill 8 of the walkers. I used one round to the chest to slow them, and then a second to the brain. I shot the mailman next, and then I killed the teenage girl. I shot 2 men in business suits and a homeless man in rags. My 15th round dropped the little boy. I dropped the magazine and slapped in another one as fast as I could, the action smooth from years of practice, but even with all my speed, they nearly had me. A 20-something who looked like she could have been a grad student had climbed over the bodies and was crouching to leap when I brought the gun back up. My shot caught her in the throat and flung her back against the others who were crowding forward. It bought me enough time to aim the next shot. And the next. Behind me, Bunny was saying, "Fuck me, fuck me, fuck me," over and over again, as he fired his gun dry and fished for a new magazine. Top fought in silence, but I believed I could feel waves of heartsick terror rolling off him as he fired. I dropped 2 more, and then my end of the corridor was choked with the dead. The walkers on the other side of the mountain of corpses clawed and tore at the bodies in their way, which was nearly blocked. I dropped my 2nd magazine and fished for a 3rd, but now my hands were shaking, and I almost dropped the clip. I caught it and fumbled it into place, released the slide, brought the weapon up, ready. Ready.
"Clear,"
Top yelled, and I turned to see that their combined gunfire had brought down all of the walkers on their side. I didn't hesitate. "Go, go, go!" I pushed them both ahead of me, and we began climbing over the heaped corpses. Top watched forward, I checked behind, as we scrambled awkwardly through the gun smoke and over the tangled limbs. A hand darted out of the tangle of limbs and closed around Top's ankle.
I kicked it loose and Top fired down into the mound of bodies. Maybe he hit the target. Or maybe not. We didn't linger long enough to find out. "This is fucked up," Bunny muttered as he pushed aside a fat man in a bowling shirt. Our hammer suits were streaked with blood, and I could feel droplets of it burning on my face. I heard a sound behind me and whirled, a snake of terror coiling in the pit of my stomach. "They're coming," I snapped as the first of the walkers clambered over the pile dead at the far end. I dropped to one knee and fired two shots. His collapsing body plugged the hole, buying us seconds. We ran. Ahead of us a door opened, and a man stepped out and leveled an AK-47 at us. It was the same man who had argued with the cop. Top put two into him before he could get off his shot. The hallway ended at another T-junction. The left-hand corridor ended in a brick wall. To our right, a set of heavy steel doors stood ajar. A man was trying to pull it shut when Bunny leaped forward and grabbed him by the hair and shoulder and slammed him face forward into the wall. Bunny pounded three vicious uppercuts into his kidneys. The man groaned and sagged to his knees. If he lived through all this, he'd be pissing blood for a month. "Drag him inside," I ordered. Top guarded the hallway while Bunny then threw the dazed man like a sack of cornmeal into the next room. We flanked the doorway to provide crossfire protection. There were four people in the room, which was a large laboratory cluttered with dozens of work tables and metal shelves of chemicals and materials. Set against one wall were two familiar-looking big blue cases. Both doors were still shut. Three of the men were Middle Eastern, two in lab coats and one dressed in jeans and a tank top. The guy with the tank top had a .45 and was swinging the barrel up when I gave him a triple tap, two in the chest, one in the head. The men in lab coats were unarmed, but the one closest to me held a small black plastic device in one hand. The other one was already raising his hands in surrender. The fourth man was Ollie Brown. He was strapped to a chair and his face was covered with blood. I pointed my gun at the man with the plastic device. "Don't do it," I yelled in Farsi and then in several other languages. He cried, "Saif al-Din," in a high, hysterical voice and made his move. I shot him in the shoulder to try and stop him from pressing the button on what had to be a detonator. But it was no good. It was rigged with a dead man's switch. Even as my bullets tore his shoulder to rags, his hand flexed open. The signal was sent. Suddenly there was a rumbling explosion on the far side of the building. The whole place shook all the way down to its foundations. The floor tiles rippled beneath our feet. Lab equipment vibrated to the edge of the tables and fell with a crash to the ground. The man I'd shot writhed in pain, but he was laughing in triumph, still chanting, "Saif al-Din!" The sword of the faithful. The holy weapon of God. The deep-throated roar of the explosions slowly subsided.
"Mother of God!" gasped Bunny.
"That ought to tell the cavalry to come running," said Top. There was a sound in the hall and he leaned out. "Shit, we got company. Walkers?" I demanded. A barrage of bullets pinged and whined as Top ducked out of the doorway and back-kicked the door closed. Bullets pelted the heavy steel.
"Not as such," Top said dryly.
"Those are AKs," Bunny said, listening to the gunfire.
"Not our boys."
"Cavalry's always late," Top muttered as he threw the locks. Bunny grabbed the remaining scientist and punched him in the stomach, then snapped plastic cuffs on him.
"Deal with you later, shitbag."
He crossed to Ollie and slashed at his bonds with a folding knife.
"How you doing, Hoss?"
Ollie spat blood onto the floor.
"I've had better days."
Chapter 64, Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 3:32 a.m.
"Ma'am, I've lost the signal,"
reported the tech, who was hunched over the communications board inside one of the ambulances. He tried another line, then another.
"Cell lines are out, too. We haven't yet set up the landline to ops. We're blind and deaf. Everything's being jammed by a very powerful transmitter. Has to be military grade. Nothing else could cut us off this bad."
Grace bent forward to look at his display and then tapped her earpiece, heard only a hiss.
"Ma'am," called the tech again. "Right before we lost our feeds, audio picked up a change in ambient sound. I think the refrigeration units have all shut down. I got 10 seconds of thermals before we went blind, and it looks like the temperature inside the building is spiking."
Allenson, Grace's second-in-command, gave her a sharp look.
Mr. Church said that Captain Ledger requested backup in silence plus 10 minutes.
She turned to the tech.
Do we have that landline yet?
Negative, ETA 5 minutes.
Bugger that, to Allenson, she said.
This whole thing is wrong. I think Echo Team is in trouble.
Allenson grinned.
Alpha Team is locked and loaded, ma'am.
Grace pointed to a technician sitting in front of a screen that showed nothing but white noise.
You. You're a runner. Find Mr. Church, tell him we have total communications blackout. Apprise him of the temperature change. We need a full team hit, and we need it 5 minutes ago. Tell him the next sound he hears will be Alpha Team kicking in the door. Move!
The runner leaped out of the van and tore across the parking lot to the fake cable news van parked outside the gates. Grace Cortland snatched up her helmet.
Let's go.
By the time the team was assembled at the door, one of her men had a fast-packed charge beside the knob.
Fire in the hole,
he yelled, and everyone fanned back as the doorknob blew apart. The door swung violently open, but beyond it was a flat gray wall. The agent pounded his fist on it.
Steel plates. Going to take a hell of a big bang to get through that.
Then a moment later there was a second and much heavier explosion, but this one was deep inside the building. It shattered the glass in the windows and sent a shiver through the walls, then subsided into a threatening silence.
That was inside, Allenson said.
Another sound rent the air as heavy steel shutters slammed into place over every window in the building. Grace let out a string of vile curses and hoped the Church had the backup coming fast.
Make me a hole, Corporal,
she snarled, but the man was already sliding the pencil detonators into place.
God,
she prayed as they backed away from the explosives.
Don't let this be another St. Michael's.
For one brief moment she closed her eyes and imagined Joe Ledger being dragged down by a sea of hungry, white-faced ghouls.
Please, God.
The side of the building exploded. Chapter 65. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 3:33 a.m. What happened? I asked Ollie. He shook his head like a dog shaking off fleas.
I don't know. I was blindsided, maybe tasered. I remember a whole lot of pain, and then it all went black. Next thing I know, I'm duct-taped to a chair, and some asshole is smacking me in the face and yelling in Arabic.
Top gave him a quick once-over and found a wet burn mark on his neck just above the collar, and the back of his shirt was soaked.
Looks like you got hit with a liquid taser, boy.
Damn. I didn't think those things worked that well.
Little dabble, do you?
Top said from where he knelt by the scientist I'd shot, applying compresses to the wounds. Bullets were still whanging off the door, but so far they didn't seem to be able to get in, and eventually they stopped firing. I don't know if Bunny, Ollie, or Top thought that was strange, but I sure as hell did. There was a keycard station outside. How come nobody was trying to use a keycard? I almost said something to the others, but decided to keep it to myself for the moment. As the saying goes, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you aren't being followed. There were too many things in this place that didn't add up. The troops should be arriving any second, I said. I looked up at the shuttered window set high in the wall. Bet you a dime they'll come through those. So be smart when they enter. If they ask you to lay down your arms, you do it. Remember, the first thing they're going to be thinking is that we've been killed or infected. Let's not give anyone a reason to get trigger happy.
I'm with you on that, boss, said Bunny.
Hey, Ollie said as he got groggily to his feet. Where's Skip?
Bunny glanced at me.
Unknown, I said. He went missing around the same time you did.
Ollie looked like he was about to ask a question, but I turned away and looked down at the dying scientist.
How's he doing, Top? This guy's circling the drain. You want to ask him a question, now would be the time.
I squatted on my heels. You're dying, I said in Farsi. You have a chance to do some good. Turn things around before you die. Tell me. What is Saif al-Din? He sneered at me.
The infidels will all drown in rivers of blood.
Yeah, whatever. I want you to tell me about the Sword of the Faithful. He laughed.
You've already seen its power. It will consume your entire country,
he said, nodding with fierce joy, delighted at the thought. If this thing is a plague, friend, then it's going to consume your people, too. He barked a laugh and blood flecked his lips.
Allah will protect his people.
He mumbled something else, but all I caught were the words Generation 12, and I had no idea what it meant.
I leaned close.
Right now, about 200 Special Forces soldiers are descending on this place. None of your infected subjects are going to get out of here. Not one. Everything you've worked for is going to stop right here, right now.
He tried to spit at me, but he lacked the power. He was fading fast. I glanced at Top, who shook his head.
You have stopped nothing,
whispered the dying man, then repeated the word, savoring it.
Nothing.
Is there another lab? Another cell?
It is past that time,
he said with a bloody smile.
El Mujahid is coming. He wields the sword of the faithful. You are all too late. Soon, all of Islam will be free of you.
Then he threw his head back and screamed out the name of God with such force that it tore the last bits of life out of him. He sank back against Top and his head lolled to one side. Chapter 66. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 3:34 a.m.
Alpha Team, on me!
Grace sprinted toward the hole that had been blown in the side of the building. The agents of Alpha Team followed her into what looked like an industrial shower, but the grime-streaked walls were cracked from the blast, and one row of metal lockers was torn off the walls. There was no sign of life.
Redman,
she snapped, and the explosives tech was at her side in a second.
This hallway looks like the only exit. Rig it with C4. If backup hasn't arrived and anything comes this way that doesn't look friendly, blow this whole side of the building down. Repeat my orders.
He did so.
Major, called Allenson from a few yards up the hall.
He knelt over the body of a man wearing a white lab coat and plastic cuffs.
Got a prisoner down, neck's broken. Blast must have smashed him against the wall.
Worry about it later.
She shone her flashlight down the hall. Every door along the long corridor stood ajar.
2x2 cover formation, she ordered.
The agents moved past her, covering each other as they pulled the doors wide and shone lights and pointed guns into each of the rooms. Four of them were empty, but they stank of human waste, sweat, and misery. In the corners there were indefinable lumps that might have been bodies, or parts of bodies. 40 yards up the hallway there was evidence of another explosion, probably the one they'd heard from outside. The walls had been torn outward and the hall was heaped with debris. A cursory glance inside revealed the high-end mainframe sequencing computers Joe had reported. Most of them were melted or torn to pieces, but a few appeared to have withstood the blast.
Major, cried Allenson. My God!
Grace stepped out of the computer room and her heart froze in her chest. What she had taken from mounds of debris from the blast was something else entirely. The team's unflinching flashlight beams revealed a mound of corpses. Debris and brick dust covered most of it, but as Grace played her own flash over the mound, she saw that there were dozens of corpses.
Bloody hell,
Grace breathed.
This isn't from the blast.
The floor was littered with shell casings and the air was a cordite pall. There was one more room to check before they would have to climb over the dead to continue down the corridor. Two agents flanked the door, and then one went inside.
Major, in here.
Grace stepped through the doorway. There were 7 corpses sprawled on the floor, all of them dropped by multiple headshots, and in the corner, huddled down, shivering with shock and cold despite the terrible heat, was a man. His clothes were torn, his face streaked with blood, his eyes wild. The floor around him was littered with shell casings, and he held a pistol in his trembling hands.
Gun!
Allenson yelled, and instantly the man's chest was flickering with red laser sights.
Don't shoot!
He cried and quickly lowered his pistol.
Please! Don't shoot!
Grace Cortland shone her light in his face. It was Skip. Grace moved forward and took his gun away from him, passing it back to Allenson.
Chief Tyler, are you injured? Tyler, have you been bitten?
She snapped.
No,
he gasped, then shook his head. He looked at the blood on his clothes.
No, this isn't mine. It's...
Steady on, sailor,
she soothed.
Where's Echo Team? Where are your men?
And though she didn't mean to say it, she asked.
Where is Captain Ledger?
Skip shook his head.
I don't know. Something happened. I blacked out and woke up here, and those things were everywhere.
He rubbed at his neck, and Grace shone her light on it.
Looks like a burn, Allenson said, then speculated. Liquid taser?
Grace signaled to one of her agents.
Beth, go back to the exit and apprise backup of the situation. Tell them to come find us and be bloody quick about it. We'll proceed and try to locate Echo Team.
Beth looked from her to the mound of the dead that blocked the hall.
My God, you really want to crawl over that? As the saying goes, life's a bitch.
It was a bad joke, and as soon as she said it, Grace was sorry she'd opened her mouth. The second part of that catchphrase was, "And then you die." The unspoken words hung in the air like a jinx. The climb over the corpses was horrific.
Don't think about it, don't think about it, she told herself as she crawled to the top of the heaped dead. Don't think about it.
She scrambled down the far side and jumped onto the concrete as soon as she could, happy to feel hard reality under her boots, rather than the yielding madness of the flesh and bone over which she'd come. As her team followed her, she saw that each of them were shock-faced and white, their mouths tight, eyes glistening. Some of them looked furious. Some hurt. In silence, they hurried down the rest of the hall, checking the last few doors, but finding nothing alive. At the T-junction, she stopped. With Beth, Redman, and the shooter back at the entrance, she was down to 9, with her making 10. She sent Allenson with 4 agents down the left corridor, and she took the right. Master Sergeant Mark Allenson was 30 years old and had been Marine Force Recon for 4 years and a DMS agent for 14 months. He was sharp, intelligent, and had been Major Cortland's first choice as her second in command. She trusted his judgment and relied on the skills and abilities he'd demonstrated in 7 separate DMS-related firefights. The team liked him, and Grace was aware that he was more popular with the troops than she was, which was as it should be. It was always better to have a more human number 2. It allowed the commander to maintain the necessary aloofness. Allenson ran along the corridor, his rifle following his line of sight. They reached another junction, and Allenson held up his hand to stop the team. The floor was littered with strange debris. Clothes, personal belongings, toys. He measured the amount of it against the number of corpses they'd seen in the hall, and the math came out fuzzy. There were a lot of bodies there, but the debris here looked like it belonged to twice that many people. Maybe 3 times that many. He crept forward through rusty water to the junction and peered around. There was a steel door fixed in place by a heavy chain. A chill passed through him. He saw the chocolatey brown smears on the walls and put it all together into a picture that didn't fit comfortably in his head.
Oh, Christ, he whispered as he backed away from it.
To his left, an emergency light mounted on the wall suddenly flared and burst, shooting sparks out into the hall that fell onto a large heap of old newspapers and torn clothes overflowing from a trash can. The paper caught instantly, and fire leaped up bright and hot. Allenson backed another step away, but a piece of burning paper fell from the can and landed on another heap of rags. Allenson caught a faint chemical whiff just as the rags ignited. Sarge, called one of his men. There's a fire extinguisher right here. He reached to grab the unit. Allenson spun around, his mouth opening to shout, No! But the world exploded before the word was out of his mouth. He and his team were vaporized in a heartbeat. Grace felt the blast before she heard it, and even as she turned toward the sound, the shockwave picked her up and flung her against the wall. She rebounded and fell to her knees. The impact knocked the breath out of her, and as she fought for breath, a cloud of smoke rolled over her, filling her lungs and twisting her into a paroxysm of painful coughing. Concrete dust stung her eyes. Nearby, she could hear her remaining team members gagging and groaning, but the sound was strangely muted, and it took her a moment before she realized that she was half deafened by the blast. The blast...
Allenson, she gasped. My God!
Grace felt blindly for her gun, found it half buried in debris, and pulled it to her, using the stock like a crutch to get to her feet. The smoke was thinning, but only enough to see a gray and blurred world. Grace pulled the collar of her T-shirt up through the opening of her Kevlar vest and used it as a filter.
Her lungs protested, wanting to cough, but Grace fought the reflexes, struggling for physical calm. When she could trust her voice, she croaked,
"Alpha team, count off."
A few voices responded. Only a few. And as she called them together, she saw that all she had left of her original team were four agents, all of them bloody and bruised. She staggered back to the T-junction, clutching to the smallest of hopes that one or two others had survived. But there was no one. The corridor walls had been obliterated, and there was a huge crater in the floor. She saw some debris, part of a gun, a hand. Not much else. In front of her, past the smoking crater torn into the hallway, where the heavy steel doors had been, there was movement. Figures, pale as the smoke in which they stood, began moving toward her. Grace raised her flashlight and shone it into the cavernous room. She could see at least a dozen corpses, their bodies torn by the blast, but beyond them, filling the room nearly wall to wall, were walkers. Hundreds of them. Some of them, the ones nearest to the door, were torn apart, missing arms and chunks of flesh. The others farther back were still whole. All of them were staring at the gaping hole in the wall. They saw the light and followed the beam to its source, and their eyes locked on Grace. A mass of shambling dead things, all with black eyes and red mouths that gaped and worked as if practicing for a grisly feast, and as one they set up a dreadful howl of unnatural need and began moving toward her.
"No. God, no," someone breathed beside her, Jackson, her only remaining sergeant. Grace knew that to stand and fight was suicide.
"Fall back,"
she cried, but as she moved backward, the walkers shuffled forward over the bodies of their own dead. Then around the bend in the corridor, she heard the distant staccato rattle of automatic weapons fire. Even half-deafened, Grace recognized the chatter of AK-47s.
"Joe,"
she said to herself, then louder.
"Joe!"
She whirled and pelted down the hallway in the direction of the gunfire. Jackson, Skip, and the remaining alphas followed. This at least was something they could fight. This was something they could understand.
Chapter 67. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 3:38 a.m. A second blast rocked the whole building, this one 10 times louder. Plaster and metal fittings fell from the ceilings and several lights flared white and then exploded in showers of smoky sparks. We all crouched, staring around, waiting for the next shoe to drop. But after a moment the rumbling stopped and the building settled into an eerie silence.
"The hell was that?" Bunny grumbled. Top spat out some plaster dust. "Still ain't the cavalry farm, boy. Wrong blast signature."
Outside the door, the gunfire started up again, but there was no way they were going to shoot their way in. I wondered why they bothered. Then it hit me. Gunfire doesn't always have to be an attack. It could also be a lure. "Grace," I said aloud, and that fast there was a fresh burst of gunfire, definitely MP5s this time. I paused and looked at Bunny, who was grinning.
"Now that," he said, "is the cavalry."
He took a single step toward the door when the wall blew up. I dove left and pushed Ollie out of the way as the whole door careened inward. Top did a neat little sidestep to avoid a big chunk of twisted metal, but a piece of cinder block the size of a softball caught Bunny on the helmet and knocked him flat. Figures began moving through the smoke. Top and I darted to either side, hunkering down behind lab tables, guns held straight and level. Two figures leaped into the room brandishing guns and yelling for us to freeze, to lay down our arms. They yelled in English. The loudest voice belonged to a woman. "Grace." I started to smile, and then I saw the blood on her face and the wild, almost inhuman expression in her eyes, and my trigger finger twitched at the same moment my heart slammed against the walls of my chest. "God, is she infected?"
"Hold your fire," I yelled, and everybody froze.
"Grace, stand down! Stand down!" She wheeled in my direction, bringing the barrel of her weapon up. Her hair was gray with dust, and blood flowed freely from cuts on her forehead and cheek. She was panting. Whether from effort, stress, or infection, I couldn't tell. Though it hurt my soul to do it, I put the deathly red finger of my laser sight on her chest, right over her heart. "Grace! Stand down!" I shouted.
Joe?
A few other Alpha Team agents clustered around her, all of them bleeding, all of them in torn and dusty uniforms, their barrels aimed past her toward me. They hadn't seen Top from his place of concealment. Ollie was with me, down behind the table, unarmed. Bunny hadn't moved from where he'd fallen. "Stand down," I repeated, keeping the edge in my voice. "I won't tell you again."
"Joe, are you hurt? The walkers—"
"No one in here is infected, Grace. What about you?" She took a breath, then shook her head as she lowered a gun. To her team, she said, "Stand down." Everyone slowly lowered their weapons except Top and me. He remained where he was, quiet and steady, while I got to my feet and walked toward her, my gun out, the red dot steady on her chest.
"Joe,"
she said with evident relief,
"I'm glad you're all right."
"I'm not looking to take a chance here, Grace. Tell me what happened."
"There was a team of hostiles holding this end of the hallway, trying to get in."
I caught that she said, "was." Another figure moved through the dust, and as he stepped into the lab, I was surprised to see who it was. I lowered my gun and held it down at my side. "Skip? Where the hell have you been?"
"Sorry, Captain. I got blindsided."
The young man looked worse than Grace. His eyes were jumpy and darted back and forth, and his smile was both brief and tremulous. I gave him a nod, and he stayed where he was, looking around uncertainly, as if unsure to which team he belonged. I moved closer to Grace. "Tell me what happened." She told me everything in a few terse sentences. The hurt in her face and voice was bottomless.
"We saw a group of hostiles trying to shoot their way in," she concluded. "We took them out. All communications are jammed, so we couldn't download a keycard code, so I had Jackson blow the door."
Behind me, Bunny swore. I turned to see the Top had helped the big young man to a sitting position. Bunny was groggily shaking his head, blood trickling down the left side of his face. Top removed Bunny's helmet and examined the bruise. Then he turned and gave me a quick nod.
"Farm boy here took a blunt force hit to the head. He'll be okay." "I ain't a farm boy, you shit kicker," Bunny complained. "I'm from Orange County."
Top patted his shoulder.
"Now that the cavalry's here, maybe we should saddle up and ride."
"The cavalry's still not here," Grace said softly. "My team is... Gus Dietrich and the others should be breaching the wall any minute."
I suddenly felt old and used up. "Well, then, we'll have to make our stand here and wait. No back doors, and I don't particularly want to go back down that corridor."
"Sold that," murmured Grace.
Ollie stood by the table looking as much like an uninvited guest as did Skip. I avoided looking at either of them at the moment. Both of them had gone missing in ways as yet unexplained, both miraculously alive despite the terrorists and the walkers. I was going to have to sit down and have long talks with each of them. It would be better for everyone if they both had nice, clear, and believable stories. Over by the door, Jackson called out sharply.
"Major, Captain Ledger, we're about to have company."
"What have you got?" I called.
Jackson looked stricken. "Walkers. Hundreds of them."
"Terrific," Top said sourly. "I'm down to one magazine, Cap'n."
"They're here."
We all turned to see a shambling mass of walkers round the bend in the hall outside and fill the doorway, rank upon rank of them. There was no time to think, just to act.
"Make a barricade."
I grabbed the nearest table to me and heaved. Grace caught the other end and we shoved it forward, the legs screeching on the concrete floor, the vibration sending delicate instruments crashing to the ground, and I hoped we weren't breaking anything that contained a virus or parasite. The hammer suits would protect us from skin contact, but none of us were wearing masks. Bunny was sick and dazed from his head injury, but he bulled his way through it. He grabbed the corner of one big table and with a grunt of effort heaved it over onto its side, then rammed it with a shoulder to drive it into the doorway. Top began tossing chairs over the table to create an obstacle course to slow the walkers down. Ollie rushed to help him. Skip looked around and grabbed another table and hauled on it without much effect. I took the other end and we pushed that against the others. Then the mass of walkers hit the barrier like a tidal surge. They were only as strong as ordinary humans, but there were so many of them. that their sheer weight of numbers acted like a battering ram that drove the barricade backward nearly 3 feet. Jackson reached over the edge of the barricade and opened up into the massed bodies. A few went down, but most of his bullets tore through chests and limbs without doing much to stop them.
"Pick your bleeding targets, Jackson," Grace snarled. "Shoot for the head."
The barricade shuddered again and slid farther into the room as hundreds of the living dead surged forward again and again. At the front of the mass, a few of the walkers collapsed, crushed by those behind them, and I could hear bones breaking, but it was weird, without screams or grunts, just low moans, even from those who were being trampled.
"It's not going to hold,"
warned Ollie as he shoved another table against the barricade.
"Nothing gets over that wall,"
yelled Grace, as she leveled her gun and opened fire, dropping two walkers with headshots and tearing away the jaw of a third. I drew my gun and stepped up next to her and fired. Top and Bunny flanked us, and then Skip and Jackson. Ollie and Skip took handguns from Alpha Team members who had MP5s. Eventually, all of us had formed a shooting line a few yards on our side of the barrier, shooting point blank at the walkers as they climbed up the sides of the tables and overturned chairs. The thunder of our combined gunfire was deafening as we fired, fired, fired. The walkers fell, but the surge never faltered. As the creatures in front died, the others climbed over them to try and get to us. The slide of my pistol locked back, and I fumbled for my last magazine and slapped it in. 15 rounds.
"Last mag," I yelled.
"I'm out,"
Top said a moment later. He spun out of line to look for one of the AK-47s, found it, and came back firing, the selector switch set to semi-auto. Grace was shooting slower than the rest of us, but she was making more kills. She aimed and fired. Aimed and fired, and with each shot a zombie toppled backward, its infernal life force snuffed out. I followed her lead and slowed my rate of fire. The walkers fell by the dozen, by the score. The dead were heaped so high that for a moment they blocked the door, but then the surge hit the other side of it, and the mountain of corpses toppled into the room. We had to jump backward to keep from being buried by them, and that broke our line. The barricade was gone, and now the walkers were climbing into the room over the heaped dead.
"Remember the Spartans," Bunny mumbled as he backed up.
"We ain't dead yet, farm boy," Top said.
"I told you already that I'm not—"
"Oh, fuck it!"
He shot two walkers who tried to rush him from his blind side. His gun clicked empty as the slide locked.
"Shit, who's got a mag?"
Nobody answered him. Those of us with bullets kept firing.
"Shit,"
he swore again, and threw his pistol so hard at a rushing ghoul that it knocked the creature onto its back. Bunny rushed over to a far wall and tore a fire axe out its metal clips.
"Come on, you undead sons of bitches!"
They came. They swarmed at him, and he laid into them with the axe, swinging it with such incredible force that arms and heads flew through the air. His backhand slash dropped two walkers with broken necks. One walker lunged at him and sank its teeth into the fabric of his hammer suit, and though Bunny broke its back with a chop of the axe, the creature's bite tore the whole front of the suit open. I fired my last shot and tossed the gun aside. Grace and her team still had ammunition, and they reformed into a tighter line, firing constantly. But now their shots were killing only one in two, and then one in three as their hands went numb from the recoil and their hearts froze in their chests. Even Grace was missing the kill nearly half the time.
"Out,"
Top called and fell back. He caught my eye and gave me a wicked grin.
"Be nice if this was like the movies. Nobody ever runs out of ammo in the goddamn movies."
Ollie fired his last shot and dropped out of the line, too.
"Now what?"
he asked. I cast around for something to use as a weapon and spotted a set of shelves made from wire racks and chrome-plated pipes. I snatched it up and swung it with all my strength against a wall where it exploded into its component parts. I picked out a 6-foot-long upright and swung the bar with all the force I could muster from need and terror, and laid into the front rank of the walkers, crushing the head of one and breaking the neck of another. I heard a roaring sound and realized that it was my own voice, raised into an animal howl of rage as I swung and smashed and thrust at the living dead. I swung low to knock the legs out from under two of the creatures, and suddenly Top and Ollie were there, both of them with shorter pieces of chromed pipe in their hands. They crushed the heads of the walkers I'd knocked down, and that fast we had a rhythm. I knocked them down, and they finished them off. I could hear Bunny's bull roar behind me as loud as my own. Top's arm was red to the shoulder. Then Ollie slipped in a pool of blood and went down with three of the creatures on top of him. In a flash, Skip was there, his gun empty, but a K-bar in his hand.